Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. After the bombings in Salt Lake City in October 1985, Brent Ashworth and his wife decided to leave town to avoid becoming a target. They still weren't sure who the bomber was. Tragically, his son was involved in a terrible accident and died just a few days before the preliminary hearing in which Brent Ashworth testified against Mark Hoffman. Brent will talk about this very trying time and how his family reacted to this terrible tragedy. Check out our conversation. One more thing, if you'd like to win a copy of William McClellan's lost manuscript, Brent Ashworth was really instrumental in finding this, and it's not a forgery. So here's the book about it, and it's autographed by Brent Ashworth as well. So sign up to gospeltangents.com/Ashworth, and you could win a copy of this very rare book. So sign up today. Now back to our conversation.
The only part of this I haven't talked about is the worst part of it, and that was my son's accident, which we were out of town. My in-laws called from Arizona, and they said, "Why don't you kids need to get out of Utah, out of that Hoffman mess for a few days. Why don't you take a few days off, leave the kids with a relative there, and come on down to La Jolla," because my wife had an uncle that had a place, a condo in La Jolla, and we'll go down there, get out of this for a little while. So I had some really strong feelings about that we shouldn't leave the kids. I did. I had some honest feelings. We'd been with them. We'd been on the run the week before. So
this is after St. George.
This is after St. George when we came back the very next weekend. Very next day when we got back. They were on us. And, it was a good idea, but I just didn't feel right about it. And the thing I didn't feel right about, they asked me, at first I turned them down, and then they asked me again, and Charlene said, "Oh, it would be the best thing for us to get away." And I said, "I just don't feel right about leaving these kids here. You know, we've just uprooted them, taking them down to St. George and all that. You know, I just don't feel right about it." We had a rule in our house at the time that the kids were never allowed on bikes on Sunday. And anyway, we went down on Saturday, and the next day, the kids were on bikes, and my brother, youngest brother, wouldn't have known that. Kit, he passed away a year and a half ago now, but he didn't know that, and he was married to Barbara at the time, nice couple, and they were staying with our kids during that time. A couple of days we were gone, a few days we were gone, and the only hour that they were not there, hour and a half or so, was during the time this accident took place. They had to go down there. A church assignment was to feed the missionaries of the MTC. And so they went down to do their church calling. And they left our 12-year-old daughter, Amy Jo, in charge for an hour and a half. Well, the boys, you know, cats away. And they got on their bikes at these, at the time we had these five little boys and two sons born after that. We had nine children all together. Two daughters, yeah. Wow. The daughters were 10 years apart, Amy and Emily. They're close now, but they didn't grow up together. They're too many years. And Emily would have just been a babe then, was small, about 2 years old. And the two youngest boys, Luke and Ben, were born after the accident, after Sam died. But so the boys are on bikes, and John, we'd given John a new little blue bike for his birthday, and Sam grabbed it. Our house is overlooks the Provo Temple. It was up in Oak Hills area, and the road feeds down about a football length from our home into a more major road going down this way, and the boys were racing to the corner so you could outrace each other, and our son Sam, who was just turned seven, grabbed his big brother John's bike, and he says, "So beat you to the corner, John." Well, you know, he'd taken his big brother's bike, and so John and the other boys were behind him, chasing him down the corner. And three teenagers in a car, in a Camaro, were coming down the feeder road, and they'd been up on the hill. It was Sunday. They had been up on the hill drinking beer and shooting. okay, on the hillside. They're all 19 years old. Should have been on missions, but they weren't ready to go on missions. And at any rate, when they saw her son, the kid in the back of the back seat said the kid that was driving, who incidentally just died about a year ago, one that was driving. Did I tell you that? Yeah. Scott Shear just passed away. He was about 51 years old. But at any rate, he was 19 back then, and he decided he could beat the kid and pushed on the gas. And my son hit the windshield and flew over the car into the concrete, into the blacktop. And they lost control of the car and ended up upside down in the neighbor's front lawn going down the hill. And I wonder they weren't badly hurt, the three of them, but they crawled out of the car. The car was badly damaged, had the trunk broken open, and there were beer cans and ammo and guns laying all over the front lawn, okay? And at any rate, they got out okay. And our son, for all apparent looking at him, looked like he was dead initially. Had flown over the car and into the street. And my daughter Amy could hear the commotion, ran out there and saw her brother laying in the street, was of course really crying and everything, really bad. And the next door neighbor was Max Golightly. In fact, his son married my sister later, and they were next door neighbors. And Max was a well-known theater guy at BYU and so on. And it was right about the time our stake president, Doug Smoot, was driving home from his stake meetings. It was getting to be dark. It was November 2nd. And it was getting to be dark. And so he's pulled over, and he had consecrated oil and gave him a blessing. And our daughter and the kids that were standing around said that's the first time they noticed his chest moving at all, was when he got a blessing. The ambulance was there within 5 minutes, and our daughter and her best friend, Christine Calder, who's now married to Clark Gilbert, that heads up Pathway BYU worldwide. Yeah, that's her husband. But they were best friends as kids, and they hopped in the back of the ambulance and headed down to the hospital. Meanwhile, our son's life, death, really close, critical condition. And, of course, by this time, my brother and his wife got back and heard about the accident and all that. It was horrible. And they rushed to the hospital, too. But our bishop just lived up the street, Stan Collins, and he was trying to get a hold of us. And before we left, because I had so many misgivings, we had written up a whole big long scenario of you know, how to call us and this kind of thing. But they couldn't find us. You know, we were down in La Jolla, and my wife and I left her parents. They got a hold of the hotel room, got a hold of her parents eventually. And we had gone out to get a hamburger and went to a hamburger joint there in La Jolla. And I'll never forget her mother running in with this horrible look on her face, saying Sam's been in a horrible accident. And we ran out and got back to the room, and we got on the phone, and we got on eventually with the doctor, Gaffain, who's a well-known brain doctor here, as our son took the accident mostly with his brain. He had some broken ribs, he had other things, breaks, but it was a head injury. It was really bad. And at first they said the aorta had been damaged, and he was bleeding internally, and they didn't expect him to live. Well, we're in horrible shock, and that was the longest night of our lives, if you can imagine. You know, this is just a week after the Hoffman thing, and so we're there on the phone all night trying to figure out. This is when Reagan grounded all the air controllers and the planes, so no planes going out. And Mike, my dad-in-law, had a pilot's license, and he tried to get a a private plane to fly us back, but he couldn't. Everything was grounded. You know, he couldn't get anything to.
Without air traffic control.
Yeah, air traffic control. They grounded everything, and so he was frustrated with that. We couldn't do it. So we were just on the with the doctor all night long, and the doctor said, "Well, he's critical." He said, "I'm afraid to do anything, but he needs a shunt put in because even though he hit his head hard, he didn't crack his skull, and we've got to do that because the brain's gonna swell up." And so it may kill him. We were making these decisions from California. It was horrible. And says it may kill him, but we've got to do it. We gave him the authorization to do that, to put his shunt in. And then we didn't know if he was going to be alive or dead when we got back the next day. We got first plane we could get was the Hawaii Special that came in, and it was heading on to Salt Lake. And so we did that. We hopped aboard and came to Utah, and when we got to the hospital, I was met by all my buddies at Nature Sunshine Products, where I was working. You know, the chairman of the board and the CEOs. I was a vice president then, and others. And they was comforting to see them. And we had a family in our ward that we were close to, the Despains. We didn't realize they'd lost a son doing an accident when he was little, and they had us. The ward had us set up with them because we all thought he's not going to make it. But when we got back, we found out he was still alive. And when we went to see him in there, of course, he's perfectly still. He's in a deep coma. His head was wrapped in the back, so his front of his head didn't look bad at all. So he just looked like he was in a deep sleep. And I said they put the shunt in and all that. And, the skin had broken, but not the... So he was wrapped back in the back. And he was in the intensive care for... month and a half, 2 months there in the hospital between life and death, you know. I mean, it was awful. And this is during the time of the early part of the Hoffman investigation, which we could have cared less about at the point. In fact, if anything, it got us out of having to contact the media and being a part of the, you know, of the early...
Frenzy.
Yeah, the frenzy that Metcalf met and others. We weren't involved with it because we had a son in critical condition. So that's why we... escaped all of that, and a lot of people never heard our story. Not that we cared, but that was, you know, we didn't. But that was the situation anyway. And my best friend Sid Sandberg, he was a county commissioner at one time. He came one night, and during the day, Charlene was there all day with him, and she was pregnant with Luke, who later was a wide receiver for BYU football.
He was what was his name?
Luke Ashworth. He's one of their best, actually. He still has the record for the most touchdown catches and a half at the Colorado State game. He had 4 touchdowns in one half of the game. He's a good player, but my wife was pregnant with him at the time. And at any rate, I took the nights, she took the days. They didn't have any accommodations for parents to stay there at night, but we'd had a son, Adam, who had been in the hospital before, and they'd really screwed some things up with him. They put an IV up in his head. He was a little kid, and he pulled it out. It was bleeding, and we determined that we'd never leave a kid in the hospital alone, you know. They didn't have accommodations for parents then. So the nurses were nice. They moved me around from bed to bed as they needed him during the night. So at least I could stay there by him, by intensive care, which was good. And make a long story short, I was spending my Wednesdays instead of visiting Hoffman. I was visiting the police after that call I got from Bud Willoughby. They needed my help. So I was going through all this stuff, and that's when I found the stories I've told you, the burned out stuff and the rest of it. But I came one day, and it was about 3 weeks into it. He was still in a deep coma. And in fact, my best friend, as I mentioned, was there one night. And the two of us were sitting there, and the candy striper nurse runs in and says, "Oh, I thought your son just flatlined, you know, died." And talk about no bedside manner. And I was sitting there with my best friend, and she says that. And it really frightened me. And then she came back a minute later and says, "Oh, no, I guess it's our machine." You know? So we went through that one night a couple of times. Anyway, did little things like that, which you do sometimes. And then it was the night before Thanksgiving. I came in on that Wednesday, so it was 3 weeks later. And my wife was pregnant. She really looks bushed. She was with, you know, she's heavy with child, and she's got a child she doesn't know is going to be around or not, and sitting there. And I come in, and my friend, best friend from work, Joe Spears, comes in, who I'd worked with for 20 years at Nature Sunshine, and he wanted to know how our boy was doing, and I appreciate that. And I heard you don't talk in front of a coma patient because they might be able to hear you. So I says, well, Joe, let's go down the hall. So I didn't want to leave her because she looked really beat up that night. But I took him down the hall. We took about a half an hour before I could explain everything and what we've been through and all that and what I was doing. And I came back really, you know, feeling sorry for her. And she was all perked up, you know, like something had changed. And I says, well, what happened? And what I should tell you, too, is that when I first went in there before Joe showed up, she kind of laid it out to me. She says, tomorrow's Thanksgiving, and I've done absolutely nothing to prepare for Thanksgiving. And you know what I said to her? I says, dear, we have absolutely nothing to be grateful for this year. Don't worry about it. Which I'm sure made her feel really good. But, you know, we're both in pain, and that's the way it took it out on her, which was
some gallows humor.
Yeah, that was stupid. So then I took Joe aside, and we went. So when I came back, I thought, oh, brother, what am I going to run into? And she perked up like something had changed or something. And I says, well, what happened to you in here? He says, well, as soon as you left, the phone rang, and a man's voice, and picked it up and says, is this the room of Brent Ashworth's son? And she says, well, yeah. He says, is this Sister Ashworth? He says, yeah. He says, well, this is Gordon Hinckley. And I just wanted to call and tell you that I put your son's name on the prayer roll of the First Presidency in the 12th. We can ask our faith, combine our faith with yours, on behalf of your son. Well, that completely changed our Thanksgiving, you know. I mean, we went home. That's the only time we'd ever left him. We went home. My stepmother fixed Thanksgiving dinner the next day. We were, for 2 hours, we had a nice Thanksgiving dinner, and then we went back because we knew he'd be all right. You know, just the way we felt. But it also showed, I think, President Hinckley could have called 1,000 people, but we were grateful he called my wife that night. So, in fact, I think my dad wrote him a letter, thank you letter, after that. So, really changed our whole outlook. I've probably talked into the ground. I think I've hit all these points. So, but Sam's accident was really tough, and eventually we got him out of the hospital. He went to Tiny Tots, which is a place out in Orem that my dad had designed as an architect. And Dad and I were out there one night looking at him in his little crib bed there. And I said, they had about 45 people. And one thing we noticed that a couple of months he was out there was that during Christmas was that we were the only parents we ever saw. Yeah, about 45 kids. And they said, well, virtually every set of parents has been divorced since their kid ended up in here.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Says they don't survive this. The parents, they're mostly young parents and stuff. They were younger than us. And, well, that wasn't in our mind and our thinking. So, you know, I asked my dad, I said, did you ever think you'd have a grandson or a family member in here when you were designing this place? He said, no. We were determined to bring him home for Christmas Eve, even just for that one night. And, they didn't want us moving him, but we did. And I should say he woke up from the coma. We knew that in the hospital when the kids remembered that he liked an Australian group called Men at Work. I don't know if you've heard of them.
I love Men at Work.
Yeah. And he liked that heavy beat. And so they were playing it one day and he was laughing. His hearing was good. His eyesight was pretty well gone. But his hearing was pretty good. And so when we could finally communicate with him, the most he could ever get was like a hi, you know, like this. But we loved to hear him, and so we'd constantly bug him till he said something. We brought him home Christmas Eve, and Dad had one of his contractor friends who looked like Santa with a big beard and everything, dressed up as Santa Claus. And they gave him a toy at one point in time, and so it kind of became a spiritual event for us there about him. There's more to that story, but that's probably enough. any rate.
And then he died.
Well, he passed away on the Friday before I was to testify in the Hoffman preliminary hearing.
That was the summer of 86?
86, yeah. It was actually May 2nd. It was 6 months to the day after his accident. And it was May 2nd and I had to testify 3 days later, Wednesday, and then we buried him on Friday. And that's the way that week went.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Brent Ashworth. In our next conversation, Brent will talk about testifying at the preliminary hearing against Mark Hoffman and how Mark reacted.
And when I got done after, it was on the stand for 2 hours, two solid hours. When I got done, Judge Grant said to Yankich, he's your witness now. And Yankich said, well, Your Honor, Mr. Ashworth and his family suffered a terrible loss the last few days. We'd like to reserve the right to bring him back for cross-examination later. So that was it. As soon as he said that, Hoffman gave him an angry look like this. He said to Yankich, like, get this guy. Okay, that was a look on Hoffman. That was worth the whole price of admission to be able to testify like that in front of me.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, sign up at patreon.com/gospeltangents, and for $5 a month, you can hear the entire interview without any interruptions. If you'd like to see the whole video, that's just $8 a month, and you can sign up either at youtube.com/gospeltangents or on our website at gospeltangents.com and click the yellow subscribe button. Or you can go to patreon.com/gospeltangents, and I'll just need to make sure that we're Facebook friends, and I'll add you to our insiders group, and you can see the entire interview uncut. If you'd like to get PDF transcripts of our interviews, those are just $10 a month. And for just $15 a month, I will send you paperback versions of our transcripts as soon as they come out. Or, of course, you can buy them on Amazon as well. Go to Amazon.com and do a search for Gospel Tangents Interview, and you can see all of our transcripts there. Don't forget to sign up for our updates at facebook.com/gospeltangents. Of course, you can follow us at Gospel Tangents on Twitter. To hear our interviews updated to your podcast player, go to tinyurl.com/gospeltangents and make sure you give us a 5-star review. And of course, you should show your support for Gospel Tangents with one of these cool t-shirts, like this green one, or light blue, sport gray, royal blue, purple, of course black, beautiful gold, and of course Utah red. I probably left out some colors, but if you want to see more, go to gospeltangents.com/shop and you can get one of these. So once again, thanks for listening. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here we've got some more of our great videos. Thanks again.